Thank you very much. I am delighted to be here. Okay. I'm going to frame this discussion by talking about what I take to be the best essay written in analytic moral philosophy in about the last 20 years, at least, possibly longer. You probably haven't read it, but it's like definitely worth a read. Okay, and it's being increasingly influential in the field. A very powerful recent essay by Michael Thompson argues that we can have no proper grasp of what makes justice involving judgments true if we think that the human person is what Thompson calls a Boethian person. Thompson's principal targets are accounts of persons as any and all finite dependent bearers of practical reason, accounts common among contemporary neo-Kantians. The problem with supposing that adult human beings with their wits about them are persons in this thin sense is that this picture prevents us from giving an adequate account of the relations that have to hold between such beings if justice involving judgments about them are to be true. It's a different kind of relational stuff, the kind you just heard. This is about mano y mano, okay? All right. Thompson's argument says, in effect, that if we embrace Boethius' account of personhood, we have to give up on theorizing justice. It's a big cost. In this essay, I'll begin by laying out Thompson's challenge to those who favor quasi-Boethian understandings of the person. Now, Aquinas' understanding of the person is, of course, Boethian. I aim to defend Aquinas from Thompson's charge. I will leave it to scholars of Boethius to determine whether or not Boethius is guilty as charged. I sort of suspect he isn't. That's for another occasion. Kant, on Thompson's reading and mine, is not guilty. Neo-Kant is beyond redemption. Happily, Aquinas does not make the mistake that Kant makes about reason. Aquinas does not treat human nature as an accidental feature of some among the many individual rational substances. So what's this puzzle about justice involving judgment, according to Thompson? Well, traditionally, concerns about justice come into play when different adults going about their own business find themselves at cross purposes. Justice inhibits our tendency to run roughshod over each other in such circumstances and may even move us to offer appropriate aid to a complete stranger who is in grave distress. To their credit, people who have a practical orientation alert to justice do not wrong each other and tend to do right by each other. They abide by action-guiding constraints recognized as such by each and every party to mutual, reciprocal, just interaction. It is because they are of one mind about such things that it is to their credit when they act well. The one-mindedness is very serious consideration. It has to be there in order for them to connect in the right way. And have it not be some illusion. Anscombe makes this point forcefully. Okay. So, it belongs to contemporary mainstream moral philosophy to hold that two strangers meeting on a road who are as different as you please might show due restraint and appropriate concern in their dealings with one another. The possibility of just interaction, we think, exceeds the boundaries of customs and culture, as well as the limits of the party's private concerns. The problem of understanding how just interaction is possible sets up several requirements for analytic philosophic work on the topic. Minimally, so these are on your handout, one, there is the need to account for the identical practical precepts informing the actions of the parties to just interaction. And two, there's the need to ensure that the parties to just interaction act from and for the sake of those very practical considerations. that the intention to show due restraint or render due assistance is embodied in what they do and what they avoid doing, even if none of the parties has an explicit thought about this. Parties to such an interaction also must be able to tell when other agents are not in this way bound to them. If I can't tell the difference between you and my cat, there's a problem with crediting me with justice, okay? Okay, such an account will begin to show how justice-involving judgments can be true. Now, it's one thing to give such an account when the parties in question are members of the same society. They all abide by the rules governing a particular club, say, or they're all members of a community bound by a shared body of positive law, or they're members of the same tribe or clan with shared customs, or they have a shared confessional tradition. Any philosophically astute theorist of customs, culture, and conscience can generate such an account on the basis of a suitably rich story about the shared sociality of these people. I mean, you get the basis for practical reasoning there, and you get enough of upbringing to get it into the individual members of the group. Any such account can show how justice-involving judgments about the doings of members of such groups are bounded in the social world that the members share. Now, it's quite another thing to suppose justice as a possibility between strangers, complete strangers. Don't share language, don't share custom, don't share nothing. There are many, many justice-involving judgments. A lot of them can be expressed in sentences about what can, can't, ought to, has to, must, or ought not to happen. Such claims concern practical possibility or necessity. There's also many different varieties of practical possibility and necessity. I can't fly to the moon by flapping my arms. I can't provide a complete decimal expansion of pi. I can understand English. The necessity and possibility in justice involving judgment is different. Justice involving claims about what one can, can't, must, should, shouldn't, ought not to do, or has to do, all involve situations where one could, in fact, choose to do otherwise. The reason that it's to people's credit when they act justly is that they allow others to do what is theirs to do, render due aid, and avoid wronging others, all that from considerations of justice. That's the sense in which they show due restraint. The necessity and possibility at issue in claims about justice or injustice is what philosophers tend to call deontic possibility and deontic necessity. Now, Thompson identifies two kinds of deonticity, two varieties of deontic possibility or necessity: monadic deonticity and bipolar deonticity. Both are sources of deontic judgment. When I act in ways that violate monadic deontic requirements, I need not wrong anyone. When I act in ways that violate bipolar deontic requirements, I wrong someone. When I act appropriately from and for the sake of bipolar deontic considerations, I do right by someone. Since Thompson is working to uncover what could make justice involving judgments true, and since traditionally justice involves interactions between parties, Thompson focuses on bipolar deonticity. You've got a little table of bipolar judgments on your handout. Now, anytime I wrong someone, I did wrong. So it might seem as though you could bypass the complexity of bipolar deonticity by just thinking about an individual's right and wrong acts, some of which will involve wronging others. This fails to capture the specific character of what's going on between two people when one of them wrongs another. I break a moral rule, offend against principle, and we hope offend against community standards if, from malice, I push Frank off the cliff. All of these things are true, but such accounts seem to lose track of the point that in maliciously pushing him over the cliff's edge, I wrong Frank. And that's not just a matter of my relation to rules or community standards. It's a matter of my relation to Frank. Something about Frank was supposed to have stayed my hands, even if something else about Frank inspired violence. Now, it's obvious that subjects of bipolar deontic judgment are reasoning agents. Reasoning agents are the kinds of self-movers that have the capacity to do what they should do because it's what they should do, and to do what they should not do even though they should not do such things. We know that it's not to my credit if I refrain from murder, rape, robbery, or gross neglect because I can't be bothered, or because it looks like it will cost me more to avoid doing such things than I'm likely to gain by doing them. If my reasons belong in that sort of cluster, then the deonticity at issue in my judgments and acts is, in Thompson's terms, monadic deonticity. I limit what I do by calculating what will be most satisfying, pleasing, beneficial, or otherwise advantageous under the circumstances. Now, things can be advantageous to me in a lot of ways. Perhaps I have a set of beautiful moral principles, and violating any of these makes me uncomfortable. Perhaps I have a long-range plan that, if all goes well, will make me healthy, wealthy, and satisfied. Perhaps there's just a way I like things to be, and my idea of order guides me in realizing a world that satisfies my aesthetic. Perhaps I just go for whatever shiniest in my current circumstances and do whatever I can to get the kind of control over it that can be got by my acts for the sake of satisfying my appetite for shiny things. In all of these cases, there are things I can do, can't do, shouldn't do, and so on. In all of these cases, I can succeed or fail. In light of such considerations, I am in a sphere of deonticity. In no case is the actuality of another agent what first and foremost determines success or failure in light of my practical orientation. The deonticity is merely monadic. If the only sort of deonticity at issue in what I do is monadic, Thompson argues, then I am not a proper subject of justice involving judgment. In Thompson's parlance, I am not a person. I am one among many reasoning agents. Mere reasoning agents do not wrong each other, even if they are, in some sense, of the same mind when they avoid running roughshod over each other or give each other a helping hand. This coincidence of thought and will is a happy accident. Justice involving interactions between persons cannot be interactions between mere reasoning agents. As such, to whatever extent we think that the organic creatures who are properly understood as persons are subjects of justice involving judgment, mere reasoning agents are not persons. Here's Thompson's sketch of the inadequate view. You have this quote. Consider Boethius. A person, he says, is an individual substance of a rational nature. Well, human, twin human, and Martian are three rational natures, we may suppose. They are three forms of intelligent life. Since the origins of these species or natures or life forms are, by hypothesis, entirely independent, the hypothetical homogeneity of the agents as reasoning would appear to be entirely accidental. Yet bearers of these several life forms will all alike be united under the one concept person that Boethius is forging, even including Martian babies and twin Earth idiots. It is the same with any grand concept under which a philosopher might bring herself and her friends, say, self-constituting, self-conscious subjecthood under a practical identity. If you've ever read Chris Korsgaard, you know how funny this is. That sort of thing might chance to break out in the Andromeda galaxy quite as well as it might down here, close quote. Recall that if bipolar justice-involving judgments about our strangers are true, then the strangers have to be of the same mind about what's going on between them, or at least the sorts of creatures for whom like-mindedness is non-accidentally foreseeable. If they're nothing more than actually or properly potentially reasoning agents, then we cannot give an account of the sense in which it's no accident that they're one mind about what passes between them. That's the problem. Now, Thompson is not much concerned with the difficulties that come of trying to interpret Boethius' definition. Thompson is not puzzled by individua in a definition that gives us a substance and its essence. He is not puzzled by the use of substantia rather than subsistentia. Thompson has never worried about how to explain why Christ is not a human person. Instead, Thompson appears to read Boethius' definition through lenses supplied by some variations of Kantian philosophy, as seems clear from his allusion to contemporary neo-Kantian emphases on self-constitution and practical identity. Now I'm going to make a quick detour through real Kant before defending Aquinas in his capacity as an advocate of a Boethian understanding of persons. Throughout, the problem that's a little in the distance will be coming up with an account of the possibility of justice between strangers on the road. Now, if you've read David Hume, then it should be obvious to you that Hume is of no help when it comes to understanding justice between strangers. As an aside, as near as I can tell, actually, Aristotle is of no help either, although Aristotle takes it that only human beings can be subjects of justice involving judgment. He can't say how justice is possible between our strangers on the road. I've mentioned that neo-Kant is likewise useless, and Thompson's essay contains a brilliant diagnosis of why this is so. Real Kant, however, has something to say. In effect, as Thompson and I read him, capital K Kant treats all finite dependent bearers of pure practical reason as beings of a single kind. When two pure practical reason-bearing strangers meet on the road, the pure practical reason in the one recognizes the pure practical reason in the other. The pure practical reason in each gives the self-same moral law to each. Their like-mindedness is non-accidentally rooted in the dictates of pure practical reason as such. And bearers of pure practical reason are any and all finite-dependent rational beings. That is the whole run of addressees of imperatives, that is, all creatures who can know the better and, in spite of this, sometimes choose the worse. If dolphins are finite-dependent rational beings, then the pure practical reason in Flipper is exactly the same as the pure practical reason in my mom. If Martians, too, are finite-dependent rational beings, then Martians are united with dolphins and my mom through the moral law given in pure practical reason. Since Kant believed in angels and the Lucifer story turns on the point that angels can err, hence our addressees of imperatives, even inorganic finite-dependent rational beings will be inwardly bound by the same moral law that capital PR practical reason gives to any such being just in virtue of the fact that it's a finite dependent bearer of pure practical reason. Given the metaphysical commitments that go along with accepting capital K Kant's view of capital PR practical reason, it's no accident that I take myself to be obliged to help a man who lies bleeding and beaten by the side of the road. Things are as they should be between us, qua finite-dependent rational beings non-accidentally bound by the self-same moral law. I see myself as rendering due aid. He receives my assistance as such. The pure practical reason in each of us explains how we're able to have such an interaction. The humanity of any creature in Kant just is the fact that it is a finite-dependent bearer of capital PR practical reason. Now, of course, the metaphysical commitments that go along with capital K Kant's view of capital PR practical reason are extreme. They are extreme because capital PR practical reason has to serve as a surrogate for what a Thomist will recognize as the distinguishing mark of a kind of creature. The self-same capital PR practical reason, however, will look to a Thomist, if I understand this, as a characteristic spread across too great a variety of creatures to provide an appropriately focused metaphysical context for justice, where angels, humans, and possibly dolphins, parrots, and Martians as well have to come out as necessarily identical with respect to practical reason, even though by Kant's they can't be identical with respect to theoretical reason, our understanding of practical reason has become desperately abstract and very far removed from anything like a specific nature. Kant may think the capital PR practical reason is the distinguishing mark of something like a genus, but it's not at all clear how to make sense of such a thought. What we need is a specific nature that can provide the right sort of source for like-mindedness, the right sort of tendency to form the kind of pairwise structures of practical reasoning at work in judgments of justice. Now, Thompson cautiously suggests that Aquinas's treatment of lex in the Prima Secundae question 90 is separated from the discussion of jus in the Secunda Secundi question 57 in order to mark the distinction between monadic deonticity and properly bipolar deonticity. If I understand him, Thompson is basing this reading on a distinction that Aquinas draws in his response to making a point about the difference between the virtue of justice, which directs man in his relations to others, and the virtues that befit a man in relation to himself. The distinction in question is most obviously a distinction between justice, a virtue of the will, on the one side, and temperance and courage, virtues of passions, on the other, a distinction that will carry through to secondary virtues that fortify and assist the work of these cardinal virtues. And here's the first place to notice that Aquinas' account of the virtues does not map onto either sort of deonticity at issue in Thompson's argument. Any question of obligation or duty that attaches to the cultivation and operation of those of my acquired virtues, whose object is my perfection, cannot be rendered as a duty I owe to myself and cannot be understood as a matter involving me and my precious principles, character, or integrity alone. I can't owe anything to myself in Aquinas. I am inclined to better myself by nature, and what this amounts to is an overall tendency in my disorderly emotional, volitional, and intellectual life to seek reasonable harmony. If I have any obligation to take steps to improve myself, and this isn't just something I owe my parents, children, spouse, say, or my students and employer because I owe them a lot of other things beside, and I'm not going to be in a good position to discharge those obviously justice-involving duties unless I clean up my act. If I'm obliged to improve myself quite apart from the things I owe to other people, the obligation rests in my relation to God, not in my relation to myself, my principles, or the shining and hard-won loveliness of my character. Any deontic considerations in the vicinity of the need to cultivate temperance and courage, as Aquinas presents this need, are not strictly monadic in Thompson's sense of the term. They're not strictly bipolar either. They have their home in my relation to God. I'll skip some more stuff about Kant. You can owe things there. Law enters into Aquinas's opening treatment of the virtue of justice through Aquinas's response to the second objection drawn from Isidore's remark that law is a kind of right. Aquinas responds, that Isidore is considering written legislative decrees, instances of positive law, which, although not the same as right, are expressions of or carry something of right. They've got something of a ratio juris. In effect, positive law as a sound authoritative decree whose object is the common good is an expression of the kind of fittingness at issue in jus, right. The discussion of lex that Thompson cites opens Aquinas' discussion of natural law. Natural law, of course, is an enormously difficult topic. I'm going to draw from Father Stephen Brock's beautifully lucid treatment of the legality of natural law in responding to Thompson. I take it as fairly clear that the last thing in the world to think about natural law in Aquinas is that its force is exhausted in terms of monadic deonticity. As Brock summarizes the matter, he's always very close to the text, very directly from St. Thomas. Natural law is, quote, an ordination of divine reason for the common good of the universe, promulgated to man by God, the author and governor of the universe, through the instilling of the natural light of the human intellect, close quote. The relevant deonticity does, of course, involve a finger pointing upward to the divine source of natural law. It's through the natural law that human reason participates in the eternal law. But this law, promulgated to us in nature through the ordinary operation of specifically human reason, is the basis of fundamental order and tendencies of our reason, passions, and volitions and actions toward good and away from evil. It provides the rational structure of human moral psychology, whether or not we have access to revealed knowledge of God's acts. Brock's discussion of, in effect, the deonticity of natural law begins with a discussion of the treatment of obligation in De Veritate. The sense in which the precepts of natural law are obligatory is special. Brock writes, quote, there is no incompatibility between the position that the precepts of natural law are essentially obligatory and the position that man's primary motive for assenting to and obeying these precepts is not their obligatory force. Aquinas holds that the precepts of natural law first win the assent of man's intellect just in virtue of themselves and not in virtue of any premise, least of all a premise concerning some evil consequences to be expected for failing to fulfill them. Likewise, he holds that the natural inclination of man's will are in perfect harmony with the precepts of natural law for the simple reason that the natural inclinations and the precept originate from the same source, the natural understanding of the human good, close quote. In this sense, Aquinas's understanding of natural law provides a solution to Thompson's puzzle that bears some structural similarity to the one we find in Capital K Kant. But nothing in Aquinas will support treating exceptionally strong cognitive powers of the sorts that seem to belong to reason as marking out a genus-like classification of which angels, humans, and possibly many other creatures as well are species. The natural law in question in Aquinas' understanding of humans as rational animals belongs to human nature. As near as I can tell, Aquinas' understanding of human nature is such that if, somehow, Martians had the self-same natural law in them as we do, this could only be because there were some humans on Mars. And the Martian biosphere was sufficiently like the one we know that the ordinary development of Martian rational, emotional, and volitional powers took the path that things are supposed to take for humans in the terrestrial corner of the cosmos. Aquinas's understanding of the rational order in human psychology is sufficiently rich that ordinary human reason is primed to embrace per se nota practical precepts covering a rich array of distinctively human goods. Among these are, of course, the precepts of the Decalogue. Quote, the precepts of the Decalogue are the first principles of law, and the natural reason assents to them at once as to principles that are most evident, close quote. Now, the relation between good is to be done and pursued, and evil is to be avoided, and prohibitions on murder and adultery is not deductive. The per se nota precepts, varyingly remote from that first principle of practical reason, are, as Kevin Flannery argues, determinations or positings concerning kinds of acts that tend to be good, alongside some kinds of acts that are always to be avoided. Flannery writes, quote, the precept one must not kill, which is certainly well embedded in natural law, in the very article in which it is said to be derived from a higher principle, is also said to be posited. What is so important about its being posited? It shows that Thomas has in mind something other than mere derivation. Deriving and positing are quite different procedures. In positing, one knows a higher principle, perhaps only in a practical way, and when faced with a situation in which the higher principle is pertinent, posits a law that has a certain independence of the first, close quote. The Decalogue, of course, includes precepts involving, among other things, parents, marriage, testimony, and property. In short, in Aquinas's account, the natural light of human reason is poised to illuminate substantive aspects of specifically human life. In the contemporary philosophical idiom of thick and thin understandings of practical matters, the finality that we share with all creatures, directing us to good and away from evil, is thin. But the natures of creatures give thick, specific direction to the thin first principle. The Arctic poppy turns its petals to the sun in the brief northern summer to attract short-lived insects to its center. The salmon make their magnificent run to spawn. The wolf pack is responsible for the protection and nurture of this season's pups and for us. Such fruits of discursive reason as custom and positive law, historically and culturally developed educational institutions, more or less well suited to inculcating the particular kinds and ranges of capacities useful for adults in a given social setting, medical practice, and a diverse intermingling of biological processes, individual thought, volition, and longing, and common social need have to be coordinated for human cross-generational survival and welfare. But if Aquinas is right about us, this stunningly complex and varied activity is the work of our first natures as human beings, of human nature, even though the products become what one normally chalks up to second nature, that is, internalized culture and local color schemes. Now, there are many ways to get at the robustness of Aquinas's understanding of human nature as rational animal nature. We could meditate on Aquinas's sketch of angelic intellect and notice that intellectual activity admits of radically different realizations in different species of creature for Aquinas. We could make similar points by examining the extraordinary variety of ways in which processes associated with inclination can be realized in creation. According to Aquinas, we could even linger over the Decalogue. I am, however, going to inch my way a tiny distance out on a limb at this point, in part because I'm specifically interested in the way in which Aquinas takes up Boethius's definition of the person. In Aquinas's intellectual world, of course, worries about Boethius's definition of the person had more to do with questions about the persons of the Trinity, particularly with the person of Christ, than with questions about specifically human nature and the distinctiveness of the human person. Aquinas's remarks on Christ help to underscore the meatiness of the human person qua rational animal in Aquinas. As we all know, Christ was not a human person. Meditating on why Christ is not a human person can underscore the richness of Aquinas' account of human persons. As Corey Barnes points out, early on, Aquinas embraces Boethius' definition word by word, arguing that accepting Christ's humanity does not require abandoning or altering anything in Boethius' definition of the person, and Aquinas seems not to have changed his mind about any of it. Pause in the early discussion. The 13th objection to Boethius' definition of a person in De Potentia, Q9A2, reads, quote, human nature in Christ is an individual substance of rational nature, for it is neither an accident nor a universal subject substance, nor is it of irrational nature. And yet in Christ it is not a person, since it would follow that the divine person in assuming human nature assumed a human person. Thus, there would be two persons in Christ, the divine person assuming and the human person assumed, which is the heresy of Nestorius. Therefore, not every individual substance of rational nature is a person, close quote. Aquinas replies, quote, seeing that an individual substance is something complete, existing by itself, human nature in Christ, inasmuch as it was assumed into the divine person, cannot be called an individual substance, such as a hypostasis, any more than a hand, a foot, or anything that does not subsist by itself apart from anything else. And for this reason, it does not follow that it is a person. Close quote. The one person in Christ is divine. Elsewhere, Aquinas writes, from the union of the soul and the body in Christ, a new hypostasis or person does not result, but what is composed of them is united to the already existing hypostasis or person. Nor does it therefore follow that the union of the soul and body in Christ is of less effect than in us, for its union with something nobler does not lessen but increases its virtue and worth, just as the sensitive soul in animals constitutes the species as being considered the ultimate form, yet it does not do so in man, although it is of greater effect and dignity, and this because of its union with a further and nobler perfection, viz. The rational soul. Close quote. Christ has a full share of humanity. In Christ, a human soul and body are united in the already existing person of the Word. There can be no question about Christ's humanity, but in his many remarks about why Christ is not a human person, Aquinas makes a number of points that attest to the robustness of his understanding of what belongs to the human person as such. For example, Aquinas argues that Christ cannot be two persons, one human and one divine, because if he was, then the things that belong to a human person would be true of the human person of Christ, and he could not have been born of a virgin. The abyssal gap between Kant's picture of humanity as non-specific, finite-dependent, rational nature that could crop up anywhere, from any source, in any odd corner of the cosmos, and the picture we have in Aquinas should be obvious at this point. Aquinas argues that the robust understanding is Boethian. If Aquinas is right, then Thompson entirely misconstrues Boethius. Now, given Aquinas' understanding of natural law, as in Brock's elegant account, law promulgated in and through nature in the life of the human being, our puzzling strangers on the road cannot be as different as you please. For example, it cannot be the case that one is a parrot and the other is your Uncle Fred. But provided that both are human beings, it will be no accident if a justice involving judgment about the pair captures what passes between them. Their pairwise power to do right by each other or to wrong one another rests in the fact that they recognize each other as fellow human beings. It belongs to the nature of the human person to be the sort of creature that can be the subject of true justice involving judgments.